Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
So he's one of the wineries. He's not a partner though.
Okay.
Andy Renda and Lou Calley are my two partners okay. in that. But yeah, it's the brands we're going to bring in there are all going to be as much as possible winemaker-owned brands that are small and boutique and
Very cool.
That you can't really, you know, easily get a hold of.
Okay.
So it's going to be like a luxury tasting lounge. We can do retail and all that. So that's just taking time. It's the experience has been pretty new in terms of never done like a build out on real estate stuff and. You know, dealing with the city and all the planning and the permits and all that stuff. Lou does most of that, but sure has been a learning experience. And
where in Danville?
Right on Railroad Avenue, across from Lenardi's Market, which is like essentially their like Whole Foods.
I know exactly where it is.
Yep.
So the Rombauer Chardonnay rules that suburb.
What's that?
Rombauer Chardonnay rules that suburb.
That's what I've been hearing.
So you're going to have to
big slutty shard for sure.
Crack of Danville, I believe, is the official name. So, wow, that's really exciting. Yeah. And again, kudos for the business acumen.
Mm.
Suburbia has been neglected and bored.
Right.
And you sound like you're bringing some excitement down their way.
Yeah, should be cool. I mean, it's definitely the right demographic.
Yep.
You know, it's very affluent over there, and you know, we have the idea that some of these houses are like 5,000-15,000 square feet, mm-hmm. huge wine cellars that probably have 15 bottles in them, you know. So we're like, let us provision your cellar. You know, we can procure wines from any winery because our license is going to be more like a retailer than it is like a true like winery tasting room.
Yeah.
Business facing or customer facing, we're gonna be a winery tasting room.
Yeah.
But business facing, we're licensed like a wine shop. So we're gonna be able to buy wines from any winery we want and stock these guys' cellars and stuff. We're gonna have a catalog that we ship out, you know, to the neighborhoods. Kind of like bounty hunter style.
I was just literally on the tip of my tongue, bounty hunter model.
Yep. We're gonna do that, and then there's a lot of tech companies in that area, or people who live in there and commute into the city because it's pretty
Tons.
Close.
Yeah.
So you know, buyouts, corporate buyouts, and things like that, and what else? There's another facet to it, but yeah, it's gonna be fun. Because we're just a bunch of dudes that grunt and drink lots of wine, and it's gonna be a fun place to be.
Well, welcome to the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Who's the third person?
Andy Renda. So he's one of the owners of the Wine Thief over here.
Okay.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Yep. So he's
very cool.
He's bringing his knowledge of running that for the last several years. Lou is he's the front man essentially. He's going to be there like every day, running the show. And then Lou's a pretty smart guy. And then he and I together kind of combining our marketing savvy to really make sure that you know we're firing on all cylinders and
sure.
doing the most best we can with the business. But yeah, I have a few clients. I have make wine for a brand called Cielo down in Malibu, so mm-hmm. I fly down there several times a year to visit that vineyard and hang out with the owners and stuff. And that is one of the most beautiful places I've ever been in my life. I mean, it's just the guy's property is amazing. I mean, if all of a sudden I won some sort of lottery and became a multi-bajillionaire, I mean, one of the first things I'd do, I'd go to his front door and be like, how much? Because I'd buy it, you know, and I would live there for the rest of my life. It's stunning. And they're cool people, too. Fun to hang out with and, you know, Gentleman Farmer is another one that mm-hmm. I've been making wines for since the beginning of their creation. I've been making Le Chanceau, which is like a little 1 acre property over in Coombsville. Mm-hmm. One lady, 1 acre, pretty much one wine, one cab. So, you know, and so I'm kind of being, if I was to take another consulting job or winemaking job, I'd be selective about who it was. Mm-hmm. I don't want to overextend myself, and I feel like, you know, I'm already pretty dang busy, so it'd have to be the right fit.
Of course.
And it'd have to make sense, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and also I have to keep focusing on Modus and growing that business, because that's my baby, you know.
Of course.
And, but yeah, if the right client came around, I would, you know, there's one I'm working on.
Ah.
And I don't want to jinx anything, but I'm close. And I would be very excited about that.
We'll have to stay tuned.
Yeah.
Once it's public knowledge,
we'll
have to propagate that to social media channels so people can get excited about your new project.
It's in God's hands now, you know. If it happens, if it happens. If it doesn't, it wasn't meant to be, you know. But we'll see.
The clients that you mentioned, are those wines available on their respective websites if somebody gets curious and mm-hmm. wants to taste your other projects?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
So we'll put some links up. Let's talk about your portfolio. How many wines you make?
Yeah.
What are the fruit sources? Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
So we do, I usually do about 11 or 12 wines a year in total.
Okay.
The core lineup, which is what most people see, unless they're in the wine club, that's the only way they would see, you know, all 12. Starting with white, we've got Sauvignon Blanc from Rutherford. It's a single vineyard, the Dalla Gasparina vineyard, right there on, Gallarin Lane. Mm-hmm. So I've been making making wine from the same 9 rows of grapes since 2006. So I have a lot of history with that one. Cool little feather in that wine's hat is that, do you remember the that state dinner at the White House those people snuck into back in the day?
I do. Sorry about that.
So my Sauvignon Blanc was the first course wine at that particular state dinner.
Wow.
Pretty cool. I do a rosé of Pinot Noir, single vineyard Pinot Rosé. So it's from the Bacchica Lupi Vineyard in Russian River.
Mm-hmm.
I also do a Russian River Pinot, of course, because that's where the rosé comes from. That's what you're drinking now, actually.
I am hugging a bottle right now. Sorry, you guys. My voice become compromised from recording a lot. I apologize for the incessant coughing, but I was about to say I'm holding a bottle of wine by Jason from a very special vineyard, Bacchica Lupi, which, in fact, if you know Judgment of Paris,
yep.
They're responsible for the Chardonnay fruit from that vineyard.
Right.
So it's a historic property in that sense, but also phenomenal growers.
Yep, exactly. Yes, it's amazing how few people know that about their family and their involvement with that historical, very important event in wine history. It's
yes.
Pretty cool.
Life-changing.
So yeah, Bacchica Lupi Pinot, we do about 150 cases of that a year. I do a red blend called Vicarious. That's my high impact crowd pleaser, lowest price point red wine that I do at 55. Pop and pour, just fun wine. Blend changes every year, so I can keep the style of wine consistent. People call it the prisoner killer because it's.
I haven't heard that. That's great.
Not kidding around when I say, like, I started making Vicarious because I wanted to. I was like, I can make a wine like The Prisoner, and maybe even better. You know, I don't know.
Somewhere Dave Finney is getting very upset right now, even though it's not his brand anymore.
Not his brand,
no. But still.
And he's a. I don't know him personally. I have reached out to him. He was very cool and gracious. And I asked him, I was like, hey, you know, I need a mentor. Would you be interested or open to mentoring me? And he said, yeah. And I never took him up on it, like a moron. But he did say yes. And anyway, a lot of people, I mean, it's kind of funny or cool. Like I was in Sunshine up in St. Helena, the market
famous
there.
Famous market, yeah.
So their wine section is awesome, right?
It is. It's crazy awesome.
So I was in there. I was looking to see where my wine was. And sure, it was right there at eyesight, you know, nice level. Right next to the prisoner.
I was
like, yes, you know, like it actually felt cool.
Yeah.
To have, I mean, I didn't put it there. The guys in that Sunshine did it. But have my wine that I intentionally created to compete with the prisoner right there. And it was a cool moment. I put it out, you know, that's one of the things I emailed to my list, you know, not to try to sell them anything, just because, like, this is something that I ran across. And it meant something to me. I thought it was cool, and it, you know. And I got a lot of, you know, replies that were just like, "Dude, your wine is way better than the prisoner." And I don't try to put shade on that wine. I actually respect that wine, because when a brand has that much brand loyalty and that much success, you know, as a businessman, you got to appreciate that, you know?
Absolutely.
So it's, you know, if you can come close to competing with a brand like that and whatever, that's a pretty cool thing, I think. Now, no one's come along offering me millions of dollars for Vicarious yet to buy it, but
who knows? The key word is yet.
Maybe, yeah, exactly. So yeah, so Vicarious is cool, and that's the biggest production at, like, you know, between 350 to 600 cases depending on the year, and that's the one that I will grow more. And actually, as I've achieved my goal of transitioning from 80-20 wholesale retail to retail wholesale, now it's time to start growing production volume again.
So that's a scaling brand, yeah. Kind of a welcoming brand,
yes,
to your
exactly.
portfolio.
And people, some of my winemaker buddies are like, why is this wine $55, man? This could easily be $75, yeah. bucks, and no one would be pissed at you for that, right?
Yeah.
And my answer is, like, it's strategic in that it's the only wine people can just buy on the website. Everything else is kind of shut down and not available.
Mm-hmm.
And I want that to be essentially people who don't know the brand and never tried the wines. I want that to be the first one they try, so that they'll, you know, I'm basically training them to see, like, wow, man, that's only $55. I'm giving them over exceeding on the price to value, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what Dave Finney's model was.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, especially a gateway is what you're describing,
right.
But that QPR,
mm-hmm.
you know, customers are smart.
Right.
They get that they're getting more for their dollar, that bang for the buck, and the fact that that's how you structured it. Yeah. Again, smart.
Yeah. So then as they fall in love with that one, and they kind of graduate into the bigger boy cabs and stuff like that, and then ultimately the club, hopefully that's the best thing for me. My holy grail, the lifeblood of the business, is the wine club. So Vicarious, so we got, I do a Syrah from the Rath Vineyard in St. Lucia Highlands.
Very cool.
Yeah, that was the wine. I was in this room a couple weeks ago watching hockey or whatever it was, drinking a bottle of wine by myself, and I was just like, holy shit, I made this wine. You know, like, it's so damn good. Like, blew my mind. Like, I love Syrah. I think that Syrah, it's coming back. People in the past, and maybe still now, I don't know, you know, they think they don't like Syrah, but I think they really do. So, like, I made this wine called Noctis, and this is really just like a one-off for the club, essentially. And it was almost all Syrah. It was like 80% Syrah, 20% Petit Syrah. So I could have called it Syrah if I wanted to. But I put red wine, and I send it out. And I know there's a few guys that always turn down Syrah when I try to send them the Syrah. They're like, oh, I don't like Syrah, I don't like it. You know, don't assume me, change it out for something else. Yes, sir, whatever you want. I feel sorry for you because you're missing out on an awesome wine, but whatever you want. So, send him this wine, Noctis. And then guess who comes knocking? Oh, Jay, that was delicious. I love that. Noctis, man. Can I get more of that? Yes, sir, you sure can. By the way, you like Syrah. And they're like, what? I'm like, yeah, that's 80% Syrah, dude. Like, you know, you just got a hold of a couple of Syrahs that didn't do it for you. Syrah's delicious wine, you know? You just got to have the right style.
Yeah.
So anyway, dude, that's Syrah. Now, that's changing. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get that fruit any longer. I'm going to try to get it again this year, but now I'm getting Caldwell Vineyard Syrah, which is pretty cool.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah, it's a lot more expensive, but... you know, it's pretty
good. It's more of a cool climate, Syrah, right?
Yeah, and that's, I'm not really sure how that fits for me personally. I mean, mm-hmm. the wine I made from it in 18 is fantastic, but I need to rethink that. Maybe I'll stick with it, maybe mm-hmm. I won't. I want hot climate Syrah.
I was kind of suspecting that your Cab lovers responded so positive, because I think the inherent, and you may disagree, but Syrah is a very confused marketing-wise mm-hmm. varietal. The confusion between warm climate and cool climate Syrah, and in addition, the Australian Shirazes that came fast and furious in the marketplace create a lot of confusion, both in the trade and consumer circles. Mm. When people are confused by something, that's usually a barrier. So that, off the bat, is not a good start.
Yeah, the style swing of Syrah is vast.
Extremely,
Like there are certain Syrahs that I cannot stand. Like I was in a was in the Viticole Wine Club, you know, Brian McClintock's, his club, and he sent me this Arnaud Roberts, stuff, and I tried a few of them, and I was just like, I fucking hate this wine. I really hated it. I'm sure it's doing it for somebody, and I'm sure they're doing great. It's just not my style. There wasn't anything wrong with the wine. It just wasn't the style that I like. You know, underripe, you know, thin, no oak at all. I like oak. The French figured it out a long time ago. Oak is your friend when you make wine. Like, I love oak, you know, and I'm unapologetically not afraid to put a lot of oak on my wines. And they taste good. Sorry.
You own your style. And the thing is, your wines always err on the hedonic quality to me, which is what I've come to love about them.
Yeah.
You really dial in that pleasure factor, which I think at the end of the day, unless you're some sort of, you know, very austere individual, why wouldn't you want that?
Right, yeah. Yeah, so we got the Syrah. And then now we get into the Cabernets. So I've got the blended Cab.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a blend of the single vineyards that we do, because we do single vineyard bottlings as well of all these. So we got the Frella Vineyard down in Coombsville, the Rocca Vineyard in Coombsville,
stunning vineyard.
The Edcora Vineyard up on Atlas Peak, which is basically, you know, adjacent to Stagecoach.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the three that I have currently, and I just signed on for some Sage Ridge Cab, which
you guys are so lucky. When that wine comes out, that vineyard seems
not cheap, though.
Oh, but I would hope not, because what I heard, I mean, I'm sure they're charging you.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Accordingly, there's some very famous people that are sourcing from there, so you're in a very rarefied group.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, the guy who manages that and grows the grapes there, you know, I spent hours with him just making sure it was the right fit for him and for me. I was like, look, you know, this is the most expensive I've ever bought fruit wise and I need you to know that, and you know, I don't want to overcommit and be a slow pay, so like I don't want to take too much. I really can only afford this. And but after, like I said, 3 or 4 hours, we were both like, you know, he wants me to be in there. I think we connected and we're on the same page. And
isn't that so important?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. The grower, you have to be, you know?
Yeah.
I think the growers often, the winemakers always get the praise and, you know, the quote-unquote fame or whatever, But the growers deserve just as much of that, you know, accolade as the winemaker, I think.
Absolutely, 100%. And I think every good winemaker is a vineyardist at heart. And that symbiosis that you have with a grower, that shows in the wine. I mean, it's just impossible to get around it.
Yeah. Those are the cabs. I do a wine called Antithesis, which is a red blend that is...
The one that's very different in terms of...
Yeah. Oh, I get Merlot from Oak Knoll.
Okay.
Boyd Vineyard there. what else? And then I do... My reserve cab is called Collection.
Okay, why Collection?
Because that's the barrel series.
Mm-hmm.
They call it... It's the Collection series of barrel. So Sylvan Cooperage, they make... like 50 or so of these a year. Only about 7 or so come to America. And I get one of them every year. It took me 3 years of begging the guy who owns the business to sell me one, because Colgan was getting all of them. And I was like...
That's quite a mighty competitor you got.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I said, it took me 3 years to convince the guy. But, you know, the only reason I know about it is because my buddy Chris was the assistant winemaker up there for a long time, and he invited me up to do a little barrel tasting, and so I got to taste whatever I wanted, and I saw this barrel, and I was like, what is that? Because the barrel is fucking beautiful. It's a work of art. and it comes with a cool story, you know. That barrel series, you know, if you walk through any cave or cellar in Napa or anywhere in the world, really, those barrels that you see were being made from trees that are roughly 150 to 175 years old. Like, that's the average growth cycle before they cut it. Well, a long time ago, the commissioner, you know, basically the king of France, I'm talking like Napoleon times, told his commissioner of agriculture to go into the forest and mark the most beautiful, perfect, pristine trees and mark them so they wouldn't get cut. So then the acorns from the mother tree would kind of, you know, after everything else got cut, those acorns fall and they force populate better genetics in the next generation of growth, right? So they say. So then those mother trees have become sold and so precious to the French government, because they manage the forestry, that these trees have been given their own specific identity. Like, each tree has its own name, essentially. They only allow one of them to be cut down per year because they're so old. And they'll only cut them if they think they're getting old to the point they actually might fall on their own. So when they do cut the tree, goes to auction, the same guy wins the auction every year. He just pays whatever it takes to get it so he can make barrels from it. And then he makes these amazing barrels, puts all the information on the head of the barrel. So you got the forest it came from, like Troncet or Allier or whatever. And it puts the name of the tree, like Chien de Bangor, Fuite Artistique, what are some of them? Fuite de Clos, Vumarat. These are all different tree names, and they're all on the head of the barrel. And they put the year the tree was sprouted and the year was cut down. And this is when I take people in the caves and taste them out of these barrels and tell them the story. That's always leave that for last, because it's like the holy shit moment, right? The Chien de Bangor tree was sprouted in 1638 and cut down in 2008. So it was like 370 years old. Crazy. So like I said, only about, you know, 7 or so come to America.
Wow.
I get one a year. And I had to basically, you know, Jean-Luc Sylvain, the guy that owns the cooperage, I was like, dude, you're selling them all to Colgan. I'd like to buy just one, and here's what I want to do with it. I've never had a reserve wine, so I want to build my best cab and fill it only in your barrels. I'll do minimum of 3 years in barrel versus my normal 2. I'll make it a blend before it goes in barrel, so it's not blended afterwards. It's going to be its own wine all the way through aging. And I'll put it in heavy glass, golden wax tipped neck. I'll call it Collection rather than calling it Reserve. I'll put the name of the tree, the year sprouted, year's cut down, all this in like gold on the front of the bottle, you know. And, you know, I think we're talking on the same language now. He was like, I love it, Jason. You must buy the barrel now, you know. So Yeah, after 3 years, three times I asked, he finally agreed to do it. So
I'm so glad I asked this question. Good story.
Yeah, it's cool. And that's that wine always seems to be like the highest rated of my stuff. I have four vintages that have 97 points of that one.
Wow.
Yeah. And points really, you know, wasn't at all a part of my business until last year. I mean, I could count on one hand how many reviews I'd had from any kind of critic for 10 years of my existence, you know, or even longer. Because for me, I didn't, and that was a conscious choice. I was like, look, I was terrified. I was like, okay, what happens if you send your wine in and pretty much only two things can happen. You either get a good score or a bad score. Yep. If you get a bad score on your first vintage, you might as well just change the name of your brand and start over, you know, because you can't come out of the gate with a shit score. If you get a good score, I was worried about, you know, people following the brand and purchasing based on the score and not based on the personal relationship or on their relationship with the wine. So played it out in my head. It's like, okay, get a good score. Immediately good, because you sell out your wines. It's wonderful, right? Now you start growing. If I sold out that quick, I should make more. Double my volume. Okay. Now you've done that a few times. Grown, and you've got, say, 2,000 cases or whatever. Well, what happens if you built your brand on scores, and the next thing you know, you get a not-so-great score, and you get all these people that are just total point whores, and they're like, you know, Jason, we're gonna pass this vintage, and we'll check back in next year, you know, on the next vintage. You're like, holy shit, I've got a mountain of wine I got to sell, and these guys, they're not loyal. They're not loyal to anything but the score.
Yeah.
So now what I got to do? I got to wax these wines off and, like, you know, wine's still sold out and all that, you know, all these kind of like flash email sites and discount whatever. Now, and then the people see that, your brand value is destroyed forever. You don't get that back, you know? So it's like, I didn't want to build it on scores. I want to build it on relationships and people who really knew the wines and bought them because they know they like the wines, right? Yeah. So I said, okay, let's see. Here we are, you know, 15 years into it. Let's see what they have to say, because at this point, they couldn't hurt me. You know, all the people in my club are in the club because they know me, they know Caitlin, they know the wines.
Yeah.
If I got a bad score, you just don't talk about it. You know, literally, you don't say anything, and hopefully no one else, you know, listens or whatever, or pays much attention. If you get a good score, yeah, you can say something about it, but, you know, for me, I just feel like I wanted validation, because, you know, and until then, the only validation I had, which is the only one that really matters, was, you know, people buying the wines, and we're selling out of wines, and people buying them, and that's validation from the customer, right? So when they came back, it was pretty much as I thought. I got some highs, I got some mids, and I got some lows, all in the 90s. So that's cool. Like, my Sauvignon Blanc got a 90. I was like, what? That wine is so good. Like, what's a 100-point Sauvignon Blanc? I don't know. Have there ever been one?
There will never be one. That exactly. Varietal will always be the stepchild.
Yeah.
And I've lamented it for decades now. I'm tired of hearing myself think that.
Yeah.
Because it's such a travesty. Especially if you take a deep dive into it, as I have, both domestically and internationally. There's some real highs.
Yeah.
And no one will ever know.
Right. So like 96 or 97 is the benchmark 100-point like score.
Indeed.
That's the curve, essentially.
So, Jason actually asked me what I'd like to have a glass of, and what did I ask for?
Sauvignon Blanc. Yeah. where was it? Oh, yeah. So it came pretty much how I thought it would, and I was very pleased, you know, with what I got. And so now we've got Parker, Jeb Dunnick, Galone, and Suckling. All of them have rated the wines. And as predicted, my style of wine isn't really like a Galone kind of style. Like, he's, you know, unless I had a big name or something like that that he was very familiar with, I don't think that I would get great scores. All in the 90s, so can't complain. But the ones that I figured I'd do well with, I did. You know, just I know their palates.
Yeah.
Just from, you know, following them for as long as I have. So, yeah. And it was cool, like, to email the list and be like, hey, guess what? You know, I just got rated. Oh, my God. You know, and here are the scores. So many people were like, you know, we're proud of you. That's great. You know, we knew it all along. You didn't need that for us, you know. And I was like, that's cool, you know.
You sound like you have a very intimate relationship with your consumers.
Yeah. I, you know, follow a lot of them on Facebook and keep up, you know. And like I said, this place is, I use it a lot to entertain them, you know. It's like I said, if you've already done the tasting experience, probably when you come out again, step two is, you've done that, let's just go hang out. Let's go have dinner, you know. Let's grab a cocktail and Rutherford Grill or something, you know. Keep it more social.
What you can expect if you join Jason's mailing list is, sounds like a royal treatment. You'll drink well. You'll have intimate access. You're sitting in a beautiful private club. And as Jason just pointed out, you can be one of those guests of his if you decide to partake. And I think it's pretty darn special.
Yeah.
The stories alone are worth it, and the wines are delicious, so I would say there's no reason not to.
Yeah.
Is your mailing list still open?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yep. We're not one of those, you know, fake sense of scarcity.
Oh.
You know, I've always, we have wine to sell, barely, we do. I've always been the kind of guy like, you know, well, you should limit the number of bottles people can buy. I'm like, F that. If you've got a credit card and money, I will sell you as much wine as you want until I'm out.
This is so refreshing. You have such a healthy approach, and maybe it's the humble beginnings, or maybe it's just who you are inherently, that you really honor people's time and money. Because, you know, as much as, you know, we all love to think that, you know, this is an industry and we're very lucky to be in it, but we somehow, you know, moving mountains, it's really not about that. It's really about the relational aspect of it. And you dialed it in, that communication, that intimacy, that access. You were so acutely aware of it. Feels like almost instinctually. And as you developed it over the years, and as your business grew, you haven't deviated from that. You didn't get so impressed with yourself that you've lost that intimate connection. And that perhaps is the most attractive thing of all.
Mm.
And that's what's so worth participating in. I mean, I can sit here and say I have a delicious glass of wine in my hand, and certainly the value aspect of it is very near and dear to my heart, that honoring the resources that people spend on your product. But I think what's most instructive is how connected you are to yourself, to where you came from, where you're going. I don't think that's ever going to change. And that's so worth supporting. World right now is so full of fake stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much posing. There's so many things that really are not worth partaking in. And unfortunately, mediums like digital media, social media, beat up on it for a moment here because it amplifies problems. So, you describe Napa, I think, very accurately, in a sense that Napa is what you make of it.
Mm-hmm.
For that matter, digital media is what you make of it. You can look for those grains of truth and authenticity and true storytelling and true passions, and you can find those things, or you could, you know, help the other realms progress because you're participating in something and lending your time and energy to something that really isn't worthwhile. So, in some ways, the onus is on the consumer, buyer beware. How do you spend your time and your money?
Mm-hmm.
And having spent the time here with you today, I can honestly, wholeheartedly endorse who you are and what you stand for.
Thanks.
And I certainly hope the listeners take note. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for coming.
Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.